You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Mariana Pomonas. She's in California. Mariana, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Mariana, I want to talk about your curatorial practice, your artistic practice, and a little bit how they come together. So maybe we should just begin with different parts. I wanted to talk about your project, your web and collective project, if that's an appropriate way to describe it, as art as social
sure.
practice project. Could you tell me a little bit about that project and how it began?
Okay. I founded a website with a professor of visual studies at Cal State University San Bernardino, Annie Buckley, and it's called Radical Actions from Teaching Artists to Social Practice. Annie and I have been good friends, and I worked for her she was my editor at Art Week magazine, and so I was writing reviews for a while in the 2009, 2010, right around that time. And Annie and I, in conversation one time, brought up that we both realized that we both had worked as public school teachers in addition to working part-time at colleges and universities, but it was something that we never discussed with other people because there is this sort of form of, I would say, symbolic oppression of that idea of the teacher as being not an intellectual. And we both kind of edited that out of our resumes when we talked to other artists, but we both discovered that we had learned a lot from teaching public school and that
But wait a minute, you're talking not about it. There is a lot of teachers that fits with art, a lot of academics, but you're talking specifically about high school as opposed to college?
Right, right. So we're both doing the same thing. We're both kind of teaching part-time at colleges and universities and then also working at some point in our history taught high school students or teenagers. And so we both discovered that we had this common thing going on in our lives that we thought informed our work as artists, but that we'd never really discussed before in front of other artists. And we talked about how social practice art was really bringing that tradition of, you know, making within a community out and bringing it out in front and placing it front and center, but that really teachers or people who were interested in pedagogy had been kind of participating within social network relations for a long time, but were working kind of unrecognized. And so we decided kind of between the two of us that we were going to start writing about that, talking about it, and just thinking about it. And it evolved into this project, which is the website. And so we have approached different artists who also have had, you know, a non-traditional teaching background and talked to them about their experience and what they've learned from working within communities. And then we've talked to social practice artists that have created kind of alternative classrooms as part of their practice. For example, Rachel Mason, who's a very famous performance artist, also actually taught at Sing Sing Prison and went there to research a film that she was working on and learned a lot about just the history of incarceration in the institution, and that became sort of what her work was about. And then another artist like Fritz Haig, moved to Los Angeles, didn't know a lot of people, and founded this Sundown Institute and, created a salon in his house. And so teaching practice really became his practice as an artist. So those were people that we were interested in talking to. And we wanted to hear about how, you know, their students had actually influenced their production and their exchange and how that in and of itself was a really interesting practice as an artist.
That's very interesting. I mean, it reminds me, this is maybe more remote, and it's an 80s reference, but Tim Rollins and KOS,
Kids of Survival,
yeah,
definitely.
So does that relate to that? Is that similar in the same vein?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that we're interested in people working in lots of different modalities, but the idea that those sincere relationships with human beings inform the way that you make your work, and that the sincerity of those relationships, can change the culture that you're operating in, and that form of, web of social relations is actually very valuable and meaningful. And I think that the idea that in some way that is to be hidden from the public, that, I think is a very gendered interpretation of how an artist needs to be a strong ego center and needs to be independent of others. And it really becomes
a conversation. So let me interrupt and ask you this. That kind of notion, which is really interesting, as I understand, you're saying that, the interest in high school and in teaching as an artist and incorporating that and letting that inform your work, is that also equivalent to the notion of which may still be taboo, incorporating parenting into your work, incorporating mothering or fathering into your artistic discipline. Is that a similar notion?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, the idea that, you know, we, as human beings, we have lots of different roles we play, and that those forms of play also, come out in the work that we make, and that we should edit out certain forms because certain forms are socially unacceptable, I think is really limiting. You know, I think also, too, as a curator, the topics that are interesting to me, you know, may come out of a very different context or a very different situation. It could come out of a parenting context, but the concept underneath is something that, you know, could be explored in many different ways. And I think that, you know, for example, I was asked to be in a show in China, and the curator of the show wanted to, you know, was focusing on this idea of protest. And I, you know, responded to it with an idea for a project that had to do with a personal relationship that I was in. So I was going through a divorce, and then I was separated for a time, and then reconnected with another person, and was going through the process of thinking about rejoining and getting married again. And so I wanted to make work about the loss of power and the regaining of power, and the idea of retaining your identity, even though you feel like perhaps your autonomy as an artist has been violated. And so wanting to think about the complexity of that social relation. And so I proposed this idea, and it was rejected as being too soft. And so then the curator and I got into this long conversation about whether or not, you know, symbolic protest, the idea of symbolically protesting in a relationship could be a form of protest. And so I brought up the Liberian Liberation Front, which was a group of women who basically refused to have sex in order to end violence in their country. And so I wanted to, you know, talk about how do women sort of assert their identity within, you know, within a culture that maybe doesn't grant them a whole lot of authority. And so how do you as a woman let go? How can you be a feminist and be married? You know, how can you connect to another person and not lose your independence? And I wanted to make work about that. And he saw that it's not being political, overtly political enough, that it was too soft as a concept. But he did offer me as a caveat, he said, well, I do like your idea. I think your idea of a soft form of protest is interesting, and that sounds like a different show. Would you like to curate a show about that? Which in and of itself was a sort of symbolic power relationship dynamic change, because by offering me a curatorial position, he's also basically in a weird way demoting me as an artist and saying, okay, well, you're not really an artist, but you know, you could be a curator in this context. And
he's almost ghettoizing the idea, right? Like, why don't you not do that, and then you do it on your own and do it with your other friends who are doing the same thing.
Right, exactly. So I got kind of pissed off, and then I started to think about it, and I thought, well, this is not really a new thing. This is something that's happened to women for a long time, and women have been dismissed, and their ideas are then represented many, many years later as being discovered by someone else. But the initial inception of that idea was initially thought of as being kind of silly or goofy. And the first person who comes to mind is a woman named Doris Cuyas, who studied ceramics with Peter Volkos in the early 70s at UC Berkeley. And she was making bread and having these huge events where she would bake bread in the clay ovens and then present bread as her ceramics. And she made books about it, and she did performance pieces with bread. You know, the idea of creating a sort of workshop situation where people sit down and eat together and make something together, you know, that's not really that far away from, you know, the idea of relational aesthetics and having an event and having everybody come together to make food and eat it. But that, of course, you know, if you look at someone who's a really well-known social practice artist like Fritz Haig, you know, with his salons, you know, that's acceptable because it's represented, the same idea is represented in a different context by a male author, and suddenly it's really well accepted, or at least it's welcomed into institutional culture. But when it's first
you were mentioning Rick Ritirov in Asia. Is that who you mentioned?
Right.
As opposed to that relational aesthetic, as you were saying, then so is that earlier work. That earlier work isn't like relational aesthetics or similar to it. It is, you know, that kind of baking bread with everybody and sharing it and eating it. It absolutely is, you know, as much as Rick Ritter or more so, because it was much earlier, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's all about the context it's explored in. And so the idea that it couldn't be intellectual because it was coming from a different time and a different place and also a woman, and then it's marketed later as something that's a discovery by somebody who's in a position maybe of more power politically within culture. And that does interest me. So when the curator said to me, you know, you can't do this, but you can do that, I said, okay, well, I'm not going to curate the way that you would curate. I'm going to curate the way I feel it would be a more or less collaborative vision, one that was more fluid. And so I got together a bunch of friends, and we formed this group called the Association of Hysterical Curators. I make that mistake all the time. But the idea was that we would form a panel and that we would create, you know, concepts and then put forward exhibition proposals, that the ideas could come and evolve out of our conversations. And it's a multi-generational group. There are lots of women at different stages. And so we kind of wind up mentoring and talking and hanging out. And then we put forth ideas. And we have a big project coming up this summer at Angels Gate Cultural Center, which is in San Pedro, California. And we're going to, you know, the name of the show is Coming to the Table. And we're creating a salon within that space. And there are going to be performances and events as well as a curated show around the salon. So you sort of feel like you're walking into our living room, and you'll be interacting with the work and with the artists and participating. So it's a more participatory event. And that show came totally out of, in a weird way, out of this sort of protest of the idea that I could be dismissed. And I have let go, though, of control of the group, in the sense that the group has no leader. It's totally leaderless.
What that emerged into is the group is a kind of curatorial collaborative, is what it is.
Absolutely, yeah, which is really different. I mean, and there's, you know, there are all kinds of things that it requires excellent communication among the group, and it's difficult, and there are times when we fall out and disagree a lot. And then
is everyone also an artist in that particular group? Are they all artists as well?
Yeah, everybody's an artist and everybody's a woman, and we're all at different stages in our careers. You know, there's the youngest member is in undergraduate school at UCLA, and the oldest member is in her late 60s. And so it's really, truly transgenerational, which I thought was important because I think that there's a real history of feminist artwork within the city of Los Angeles. It's been a center for a long time. And I thought that, you know, it would be interesting to have dialogues across generations like that, because I know some of the artists that have been around making work for 40 years in LA and survived it, you know, have definitely really interesting perspectives. They've also seen everything. And so if there's been an iteration of an idea, there's just this incredible resource of institutional knowledge, like our memory, institutional memory within the group, that just comes to the table with the range of ages, which is awesome.
That's wonderful. And let me ask you now about this show you're curating at Charlie James.
Okay. So that show is, it's Rosette is the name of the show. And, you know, I got offered to curate a show there. Charlie and I are friends, and he came into the studio visit, and he said, do you have any ideas? And at the time, you know, I was talking very recently to Sabine Ott, who is my mentor in graduate school. I went to grad school in St. Louis, and Sabina was there during the late 90s when I was there, and I have a beautiful print that was printed by Sirius Edition in the early 90s that she gave to me, and it was hanging in my living room, and she won a Guggenheim Award last year for her project called Dream, which is a wonderful gallery that's in the front of her house, so sort of a lawn gallery, which uses the porch and the artists come in all to the front. So I've always been very inspired by Sabina. She was really a wonderful teacher. And of course, I'm very interested in, you know, teaching artists. And I've been looking at this work for a long time. And the title of the series is Matter Rosa, and it's all based on Gertrude Stein poetry. And so there are roses throughout the piece, and it's one of those images. And I remember Sabina saying something to me, that whenever something is cliche and unlooked at, look at it again. You know, don't overlook things that you think you understand or that culture understands, because there's always something there that you're not seeing. And, you know, to do rose paintings or flowers, you know, in some ways a real knock on the sort of Sunday afternoon watercolor painter. But this painting, it just vibrates. It's very alive, and it also is very sad. There's an element of, if you repeat a rose is a rose is a rose, you get the sense of a body rising up and you get the sense also. So it's all of the things that roses and flowers imply, sex and death, you know, just the beauty of offering. So I was looking at it, and Sabina also has been very sick. In the last year, she was diagnosed with lung cancer. So, you know, going through this experience with her, watching her, you know, fight cancer and deal with illness, physical illness, but also watching her win this big award and really reach a kind of career high for her. And I just feel a lot of things looking at this image, and then also just the wisdom of time, because, you know, I'm around the age she was when she made that print. And so I was thinking a lot about that as an image. So I decided to sort of curate that show around her piece. And I reached out and wrote a statement, and I said, you know, I wrote about the rosette as being both a funerary symbol that is something that goes back to ancient Greece and Sumeria, and, you know, then also being the sort of the floral references of life and death, and talked about that, and is the connection between decoration and concept. And I sent it out to a bunch of artists, and I just kind of reached as far as I could. And within a day, I heard back from everybody, which has never happened to me as a curator, that every single person I sent an invitation out to said yes. So that was kind of overwhelming. So it came together really quickly. So unlike the hysteric curators where it's very slow, the curatorial process is very slow, this one went very fast. But I was able to secure work from Mattia Biaggi, who's an Italian artist, who made a beautiful sculpture that's going to be at the Palm Springs Art Museum this summer, and he graciously loaned it to us. And it's kind of it's freestanding, and it looks like a Greco Buddhist sculpture. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And there, Mark Dutcher, who made these scene craft flowers out of bronze and wax. Kristen Calabrese, who made these beautiful oval paintings on cardboard that have like folded, what look like folded black plastic surfaces, but they're actually trompe-l'oeil painted surfaces that look like folded black plastic on cardboard, but they're painted perfectly. Vincent Ramos, who made all these rubbings and frottage images of like lace and Tupperware together that have the rosette form in them. So people really reached for, you know, the concept and made incredible work as a response to the, what I thought was kind of an offhanded in a way idea, but the depth of the meditation was really interesting. Allison Stewart's photograph of a soldier, kind of, you know, it's a man who's dressed in costume as a reenactor. He's sort of lying face down, playing dead in a bed of flowers. And this incredible image of both death and life. I mean, it's literally the playing of death, but
wow.
Then it also looks like this meditative image of this body flying or floating over flowers, but it's, you know, it's a person dressed up as a soldier.
Well, it sounds like a beautiful show. There'll be when are the dates of that show?
So it's up until the 20th of February. It's been up for a while. We're doing another curator's walkthrough on the 20th at noon. But it's been, you know, it's gotten a lot of attention, which is also was kind of a surprise because it happened very quickly. But it's one of those things that was really great to be able to do something as a tribute to Sabina, who I love very much, and who's a teacher who very greatly inspired me as a young person, encouraged me to keep making art and to move and get out of the Midwest. It was the main theme.
Right. So that's exciting. And let's talk about your performance. You have a performance that you're working on now in your own studio, don't you?
Yeah, I'm working towards a show that's at Woodbury University, curated by Doug Harvey. And the title of the show is Abstract Spirituality. And so he kind of sought out people who had done performances or made paintings or work that was based in some kind of either spiritual or alternative practice. And I've been doing performances for a while. And this character that was like a Roman flamen, so, and like priest robes, and using ancient poetry as a part of repetitive actions and interacting with painting processes that way in public, he saw
a Roman.
One
wait,
of
wait,
my
wait! I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You said a Roman. What's the title?
Flamen, which is a priest, a Roman priest from ancient Rome.
But flamen, you said flamen, not
flamen,
shaman.
Yes.
Shaman.
Yeah, flamen. No, it was spelled like flame. You know, and I found all these poems by Catullus, and then I was also looking at, just other ancient poetry and thinking about it. But
so, tell me, that's
process,
cool. What does a flamen do? I mean, if I'm not trying to interrupt, but then now I'm
right,
really interested.
Right. So I'm getting to that. So I through this process, I discovered a female poet, Enhedduanna, who was actually a Sumerian priestess, and she was the first person to ever have written poetry or any kind of prose form, the oldest recorded poet, or actually oldest recorded form of writing, because she wrote in cuneiform. So you're talking 2500 BC, 550 years before Hammurabi wrote the Code of Hammurabi. This woman published what would be considered today like an ancient blockbuster poem. And all of these poems exist. They exist on tablets. And she actually kind of, she was the daughter of King Sargon. And what she did that really helped her father was she wrote poetry for every different site. So every temple in Sumeria and Akkadia at the time had a poem that was written for it by her, and she codified all of it. So she even signed her poetry saying, I know I'm the first person to have ever done this, which I was completely floored by. So I thought, why am I researching Catullus and ancient, you know, these ancient male poets when I could look at someone who is somebody I've never even heard of before, but who has this incredible library of work that is just unfamiliar to Western audiences. And so I started structuring a project out of that. And what I do is I record myself reading. There's a really great translation by Betty Deschong Meador. And she, you know, translated from the original text, which is incredible. And so I'm reading from it. Lady of the Largest Heart is the name of her largest poem, her longest, most epic poem. And so I'm reading from that live, and then I'm going to be reenacting a live painting in a trance wearing a costume and mask so I can't see my hands as I'm painting.
Wait, you're going to reenact a live painting in a trance in a costume?
Yes, reciting the poem.
So that's cool. How do you get into that trance, and is that kind of an improv, or is that something planned out? So that's
well,
two questions.
You know, for me, speaking is a form of trance. I mean, I think that writing, speaking, and, the idea of repeating the same words over and over again puts me into another otherworldly space. I'm definitely a person who gets energy from speaking. And I said at the beginning, I'm a nervous talker. But the process of reading and repeating words, I think, is a magical process for me. I'm Greek. That was my cultural tradition growing up. And in Greece, people have, a lot of primitive beliefs about writing. And I wouldn't say primitive is the right word, but a lot of deeply rooted beliefs about writing. You know, if you write something down, that makes it real and it makes it magical. And so you're supposed to be very cautious and very careful about what you write because you're giving life to the thing that you're inscribing on the paper. And the idea that an artist has that same kind of magical power to, bring a vision to life on a piece of paper, that process of speaking also is given and granted the same process. So if something translates from hand to mouth to the world, you have another altered state that you're an altered state of consciousness that you're making from and that you're sharing with others. And when you try to create a space in performance, you're trying to bring people into the spell of that space. And it is like spell casting.
So then in the acting part, the movements itself, acting out of painting, what does that mean? That sounds narrative somehow.
Yeah, well, I mean, the process of, I start with, I've always been, well, first of all, I should say, I've always been very inspired by people who make, goofy live painting to music. Like my dad owned a restaurant when I was a little kid, and he once took me to the food show, and there was a guy painting to like Jimi Hendrix, and the very last stroke, you see his face, he adds the last line or the last dash of color, and it's like this kind of silly Jackson Pollock-y looking pastiche of painting. But I was just absolutely transfixed. All of his movements were planned to the music, and then when he was done the last stroke, you finally saw the picture, and it was this magical moment of he brought this thing to life, but he also teased me all the way through it. So I've always wanted to do a live painting performance. And Doug Harvey and I have very similar senses of humor. I don't know if they're the same, but I think he and I talked about that one time, and he thought that was really funny. But the idea of doing it and doing it in a way that was different, so that you take your studio and turn it outside and make it into a spectacle or a ritual that people can participate in, I think is fascinating. So what I'm planning to do is to remove my painting from the gallery space, walk it outside, put it down on the ground, repeat the poetry until I get into the state, and then put on my blindfold and paint, and essentially kind of destroying the surface that's under it or covering it up or changing it in some way, and then replacing it with another similar painting that so that the show will be having images swapped out every time I do a performance, so it'll be changing. And then on the very last iteration of the performance, I will be cutting up and handing out pieces of the painting to people to take with them, sort of like, you know, they have these religious sites in Greece where you can go to, and they're all over the world, but if you go to different churches, they hand you a piece of, like, the saint's slippers, or you can get a little fragment of hair or some piece of that's a relic. So it'll be like a relic of the performance that you get to take home with you, but it'll be, you know, the destroyed or the transformed paint.
I love that. When will that open?
March at Woodbury University. And I should look up the dates. I know exactly, so I don't.
Well, there'll be a link in this interview as well to so people can get to that. That's an exciting performance. I'm really glad you talked with me today. It's been great to go over these three projects with you. I think they're all really inspiring in a lot of ways, as well as really interesting. Is there anything you want to leave the audience with that I missed, or you want to point them to for any reason? There will be links on this to the different shows and the information that we covered.
You know, the Radical Actions website will be up. We're going live on Valentine's Day, so that should be pretty exciting. And that's going to be, I think, a really exciting resource for teaching artists and people that are creative, and even teachers who want to incorporate, you know, interesting curriculum or ideas into their practice. And the other stuff that's going on in my life, if you're promoting it for me, that's awesome.
Well, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.